Hello and welcome to The Pioneers, brought to you in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. I'm Robert Bound. This series explores some of the most innovative ideas in science, technology, conservation, medicine and beyond that are making the world we live in a better place. Today we meet the marine biologist Emma Camp. As reefs around the world are becoming endangered, she's been searching the world's toughest corals to help preserve them. Earlier this year she spoke to Henry Reece Sheridan about her work, and later on we caught up with her as she started her expedition into Australian mangroves.
Emma Camp, thank you so much for joining me. Who are you and what do you do?
Thank you for having me as well. My name is Dr. Emma Camp. I'm a marine biologist focusing on the impact that climate change is having on the world's coral reefs. I'm also a 2019 Rolex Associate Laureate, and I currently hold a UN Young Leader position for the Sustainable Development Goals.
Marine biologist is one of the few kind of science research jobs that might rank in the top 10 of childhood fantasy careers. How did you get to where you are today?
It's funny you say that, actually, because I have pictures from when I was about seven where I drew that I wanted to be a marine biologist. So it's always been a passion and love of mine. And when I was about 12, maybe a little bit younger, I was lucky enough to go see a coral reef over in the Caribbean with my family. And I put my head under the water, and it was the first time that I just saw this amazing underwater world. And it really just started my love and passion. And then I went on to study, and here we are.
So what specifically did you study? Like, take me through kind of how your scientific career developed and how you came to specialise in coral reefs.
So my background was in environmental chemistry, and so it took me a while to really find out sort of exactly what my area sort of a focus would be, but I always had this burning love for coral reefs. Went on to do a master's in environmental management and business because I wasn't sure that I would actually get a field job as a marine biologist, because it still felt maybe a little surreal that that would actually, you know, become my day job. And then took an internship over in the Caribbean, had very little pay, but amazing experience. And through that, I've got experience and the opportunity to do a PhD on coral reefs. And from that, took every opportunity, really. And yeah, it became my career.
What is coral?
Great question. So we call coral a holobiont, which means a whole biology, because it's actually an animal that has microalgae that lives in its tissue. And the microalgae is really important because it photosynthesizes and gives the coral a lot of the nutrients that it needs. And there's also bacteria and viruses that all sort of like work together to form this complex system.
And why is it important as an organism? Like, what role does it play in the ecosystem?
So coral are basically the foundation of coral reefs, and coral reefs have many really valuable ecosystem services, which include, for example, storm protection. So if you're a coastal community adjacent to a coral reef, the coral reef dissipates the wave energy as they come into shore. Many fisheries actually rely on coral reefs, so the fish at some time in their life will spend time on a coral reef. Many chemical compounds that are found in pharmaceuticals actually come from corals or some sort of member of an organism that lives on a coral reef. And then it's also actually really important in chemical cycling in the ocean. So it really has a lot of value beyond, obviously, as well, for some areas, cultural significance and economic significance through things like tourism.
The most famous coral reef is obviously the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, which I know you spent a lot of time I'm not sure if that's the right preposition, but like swimming around. What's your relationship to the Great Barrier Reef?
So it is indeed sort of my study location at the moment. And I visited the Great Barrier Reef the first time in 2016. I got a government fellowship to go over and work in Australia. And this was a really significant year because, unfortunately, when I arrived, it was the first of two very severe back-to-back coral bleaching events on the Great Barrier Reef. Now, a bleaching event is basically when the algae leave the coral because of a stress event, and this often happens when it gets too warm. So that was when I basically arrived that Australia was experiencing this really severe coral bleaching event that ended up killing about a third of the Great Barrier Reef.
A single event?
A single event over 2016 and 2017. So it was two sort of events over 2 years. But yeah, this sort of severe sort of marine heat wave that caused this mass die-off. So that was really, unfortunately, my first sort of experience of the Great Barrier Reef. And from that really spurred my motivation to try to understand how some corals have got resilience to stress and how we as scientists and conservationists can try to use this knowledge to sort of better aid the future survival of coral reefs when all of this stress is going on.
Now, what does it mean to say that a reef or part of a reef has died?
So it's a really good question. So if we take the Great Barrier Reef, it's the size of Italy. So when we say part of it's died, it might be that a town or a county in Italy has been wiped out, for example. So if we take the Great Barrier Reef during a bleaching event, some parts of the reef may have been totally killed. So, for example, the Great Barrier Reef is so big that it goes across two latitudes. So there's a temperature gradient from north to south, depending on local weather patterns and sort of tidal influences depends on actually how warm different parts get and how severe sort of the stress is. So it's very patchy, but overall we're seeing this ongoing decline, unfortunately.
And when coral dies, does the physical coral like disperse? I'm trying to kind of like imagine what it's like. Obviously, when an animal dies, it biodegrades and it's not there anymore. Does the same thing happen to coral?
So the actual reef framework itself will still often be there. So basically, it looks like rock. If you didn't know that it was actually sort of previously the structure of a coral due to its shape. What actually myself and some colleagues showed this year was that actually after the severe marine heat waves, like what we saw in 2016 and 2017, that we actually can have a really rapid dissolution of even that dead framework. And that's a problem because if the framework breaks down, the available substrate for baby corals to basically recruit onto is being lost. So that's only under, we only sort of documented that under these really severe marine heat waves. But again, we're predicting that's going to increase into the future. So again, it's sort of another problem that I guess corals are going to have to sort of contend with.
Now, you mentioned they're introducing or reintroducing baby coral onto the kind of physical structure where living coral used to be and kind of reinvigorating it. Tell me a bit about that process and what is that? Is that kind of like bringing the coral back to life, or how would you describe it?
Okay, so in that context, corals reproduce generally once a year through, like, there's two ways they can be: broadcast or spawning corals. So we see these mass spawning events once a year where the corals will release their sperm and eggs into the water column at once. And if you've ever seen any of the online documentaries, it's really spectacular to see and kind of looks like something out of this world. And then they'll settle as larvae and you can get new corals. So that's a natural process that goes on. You can also have asexual reproduction, which is that the corals just break. And when they break, they may then be able to reattach. And when that happens, it's genetically exactly the same as obviously the sort of parent that it broke off from. So as scientists, we're now trying to see if we can utilise both of those methods to try to sort of facilitate and enhance coral abundance in areas that have been lost. Now, we have to understand it due to the size of the reefs. Our ability to do this at the moment is only over small areas. So one area, for example, if you've got a high value site, either ecologically or say a high tourism site, people can set up things like coral nurseries where you actually grow the corals on mesh frames, and we find that they, a bit like if you clip a plant, you get new clippings and sort of shoots come out. The same with the coral, if you clip it, it'll grow very quickly and then you can replant it. But obviously it's quite a lot of effort to do this.
You drew an analogy with kind of replanting plants, you know, areas of plant life that might have been destroyed. Obviously, there's a difference between a tree which is 100 years old and a tree which is 10 years old. Do we see a similar difference in coral, kind of qualitative differences, depending on how long they've been there, when they were planted?
Yeah, definitely. So we know, depending on the species of coral, they need to get to a certain size before they are sexually reproductive. So that's sort of the key thing that we want, is to actually get corals to a size where they can be reproducing on their own. And that's really variant for each species. Also, oftentimes, obviously, the bigger the corals are, obviously, the more actual 3D structure they provide to the reef for things like fish habitat. So you really want, obviously, the bigger corals to be there. But again, if you take small clippings, then potentially you can sort of try to sort of speed up getting some additional coral cover.
Now, one aspect of your research is the study of so-called super corals. What's a super coral?
Great question. So I'm always hesitant of using this word super as a scientist, because it's quite subjective, but it's become very, very popular. And so what we mean by super coral is simply a coral that has superior traits of survival under stress. But why I'm hesitant to use it is that we need to contextualise what is super. So is the coral, for example, super to temperature stress, or super to low pH, or what is it that it has better ability to survive against? So my interest has been looking at corals that live in mangrove lagoons. And the reason that I've been looking there is that the water's naturally generally a little bit warmer, more acidic, and also has lower oxygen than the adjacent reef. Now, those three stresses are what the ocean is experiencing and will continue to experience under climate change. So by studying the corals that naturally are able to survive in these conditions, we can, one, see what are the trade-offs in surviving there. So, for example, we see that the corals generally grow slower. That's a compromise to survive there. We can see which species are able to survive there. So if we're going to start to try to look at sort of human intervention, maybe they're the species that we should be focusing on. And ultimately trying to understand what mechanisms the corals need to be able to survive stress, so that we can maybe through our management try to enhance the conditions that will facilitate them doing well.
You've also studied the impact of scuba diving on coral reefs, and obviously a huge source of tourism in many parts of the world that have large reefs is people who want to go out and scuba dive and snorkel in the reefs. What is the impact of that kind of activity?
So that was one of the first studies that I did as a researcher, actually, and that was based in the Florida Keys. And in that particular area, there was a really concentrated area of divers in a really, you know, localised area. And it found that a lot of divers did interact with the reef, but positively, that a simple educational briefing prior to the dive could really minimise the impact that divers were having. And that was really important, because it's something that obviously people can really easily act upon. So tour operators can provide those conservational briefings to minimise that stress. And especially because I think that actually having people see the reef is really, really important, because you get that connection to why it's so amazing and why you should preserve it. So, yeah.
What kind of interactions? I feel that was a euphemism. Are you talking about people literally just going in there and breaking things off, or what?
No, not necessarily breaking things off, but actually, you know, maybe if they haven't got great buoyancy in the water, they might put their hand on it to stabilise themselves, or accidentally kick with their fin. If they've got loose equipment, so if you go scuba diving, you have sort of gauges and a spare mouthpiece to breathe from. And if you don't secure those on you, they might drag and get caught on the bottom. So it doesn't necessarily mean that they've physically broken the coral. It's just that they've sort of maybe rubbed up against it, maybe broke it. But again, any of those interactions seem to be minimised by simply reminding divers that the coral is alive, that it is an animal, that, you know, it can be minimised just by sort of tucking in your gear and remember to not touch the coral.
So from what you said, it sounds like there's a bit of a tension between the kind of greater awareness for or respect for the coral reefs that tourism engenders and its potential impact on the actual physical reefs.
For me personally, I think that, you know, the tourism industry is really fundamental, important to show people the reef. They're a major stakeholder. I work closely with many tour operators on the Great Barrier Reef. And so I don't feel that there necessarily has to be a tension. It's just ensuring that the messaging about the state of the reef is balanced across all sectors, and that we work collaboratively to basically ensure what we all want, which is, you know, a healthy coral reef in whatever region we work in.
So tell me a little bit about some breakthrough moments that you've had in your career, how they came about and what they felt like when they happened.
So we're actually going to start before a breakthrough moment, sorry to diverge, but sort of one of, I guess, a key moment for me as a scientist that's sort of led to part of where I guess I am in terms of some of my breakthroughs. In early 2016, before I was on the Great Barrier Reef, I was in the Seychelles, and that was the first time firsthand that I'd seen a coral reef bleach. So basically you've gone from being healthy and full of colour to stark white, so the algae had left the coral and then had turned algae covered and died. So within a week, I saw an area that was about the size of 3 to 4 football pitches go from teeming with life to stark white to being dead. And for me, that was one of the moments that, you know, I mean, I was crying underwater, literally. It was, you know, this has happened because of human impact. And so for me, it was a really a turning point in two reasons. One was actually realizing that no matter what sort of local impact we try and do as researchers and scientists, we fundamentally have to reduce reliance on fossil fuels and deal with climate change. And if that doesn't happen, any action that we're trying to do locally or globally really is going to be short-lived. The second part then was that we're not seeing climate action happen quick enough. So what can we do as scientists to build resilience of the reef, because that's what we need to do to try and give them the best chance to survive. So this then led to, I guess, one of my breakthrough moments, which was your initial question, which was during my PhD, I wanted to see if there were sort of systems adjacent to reefs that offered them some service that maybe would boost their resilience. And this was where, just through sort of having handheld sensors that read things like temperature, pH, oxygen, I went around with some colleagues and we saw that the mangrove lagoons had these really extreme conditions, but yet there was coral surviving there. And that was really sort of that aha moment that, wow, some corals can survive in very extreme conditions and we need to use these areas as sort of natural labs to understand how they're there and then, you know, provide that knowledge to sort of boost some of that resilience that the reef so urgently needs.
You've really kind of taken up the mantle of advocating for a more sustainable relationship between human activity and the oceans and the earth more generally. And you're here in New York in your capacity as a UN young leader for the Sustainable Development Goals. And we're speaking actually just a couple of days after Greta Thunberg captured the world's attention with her speech about climate action at the UN. What do you make of the state of climate activism and the debate around it?
So I think that climate activism is helping to get the issue on the map more than it has been. And not just through, you know, amazing individuals like Greta who are, and other school children globally that are out protesting on the streets, but also this isn't something that's happening in the future. You know, it's happening now. If we take Australia, we're having bushfires, we're having unprecedented flooding, drought. We're seeing severe cyclones and hurricanes like we've seen in the Bahamas. So the actual impacts of climate change are affecting people. So people are protesting that they want their governments to take action. So, you know, I feel that the activism is needed to keep the attention on the severity of the problem and really put pressure on, you know, politicians to actually act on, you know, the severity of the climate crisis and move beyond just discussion.
It's easy to get people to donate money to your charity, if you run a climate charity, if there's a panda on your leaflet or on your website rather than like an insect, which might be, you know, equally or if not more ecologically vital, but just doesn't tug on the heartstrings quite as much. And you may think this is unfair, but I've looked at some pictures of the super coral that you work with on your website, and it's somewhat browner than the coral that might feature on people's kind of screensavers. I wonder if you face the same kind of dynamic in advocating for the protection of natural resources which aren't kind of conventional animals or the animals that people are used to. Like, is it easier to get people to engage with you if you've got these kind of like amazing, conventional, beautiful corals rather than, you know, these kind of amazing structures, but ones which are kind of in shallow waters in mangrove swamps?
Yeah, no, definitely. And, you know, really for me, obviously the mangrove swamps are just one example of these sort of more resilient corals. And ultimately, we want people to actually fall in love with the reef itself. And even that's quite challenging because, you know, the biggest sort of misconception that I often have is people say to me, oh, well, you know, the coral's just a rock, isn't it? Or it's just, you know, it's not actually an animal, it's not actually alive. So for many people, you know, they don't even see it as an animal, and therefore how are they going to have that connection, whether it's in a mangrove lagoon or on the reef itself. Now, you make an interesting point about the colour, because there's another sort of misconception here, which is that the really fluorescent bright colours that you often see online and in pictures is actually often the first sign of stress. So when you see those bright purples, pinks, yellows, as a scientist, that for me is a big warning sign that that coral is stressed, because they're the pigments that the coral is basically using. You can imagine a bit like a sunscreen, or trying to sort of minimise light stress and any other stress that it's got going on. So actually we quite like the darker yellows and golds, but I appreciate that. I agree, definitely it's harder to engage. It doesn't have the same effect, let's say, as a panda, as you said.
Is there a tension for you between your advocacy work, which obviously your scientific work, you know, very directly and logically leads to, and your objectivity as a researcher?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I was recently asked about this in terms of the context of ecological grief, having seen so much of the reef sort of get lost. And I think, as a scientist, from an early age, when you begin as a scientist, you're trained that you have a hypothesis and you have to test that, and your results come out either favourably or non-favourably. And so, you know, when you go into being a scientist, that's your mantra that you hold true to. Now, obviously, when you work on something like corals and that's your passion, you're obviously connected to that. But there will be potentially research that you undertake that doesn't, the results don't follow what you anticipated. But as a scientist, that's your, you know, moral responsibility to report those. So, yeah, I think it's just, you know, you have your emotional connection, but when you're doing your research, it stays objective because it has to. And that's really, you know, what it means to be a scientist.
Women are underrepresented in science and technology, and that's often framed as a pipeline problem, that, you know, not enough women and girls are getting involved in science in the first place. But you've pointed out that the retention of women in science who have already chosen scientific careers is also a major issue. What are the particular challenges facing women in science?
Yeah, that's the retention is something that I've really sort of been focusing on, because I've seen by, you know, women around me that there is a loss from STEM subjects. And the reason for that, I think, is multifaceted. One of them being, you know, if women decide to have children, actually, because science is so fast moving, actually getting back into science can be quite challenging unless there's specific fellowships or grant opportunities made available. That can be gone. A lot of science positions are actually contract or, you know, not permanent positions. So again, if someone leaves to have a child, it can be very hard to return. And then I think there's still sort of some fundamental issues in terms of just having diversity on things like editorial boards, in more senior academic positions or within companies. And if you look at the higher levels, there seems to be this loss of women in the sciences. And I think not just, I guess, sort of the issue of having a family, but also it can be quite tough, you know, job to, you know, you're constantly trying to find funding and you're dealing with rejection, depending on how your, you know, research is accepted or not in the community. So it's quite a tough career to stick out. And again, there's not always the support maybe there for females in STEM.
In the picture above the bio on your website, you're very much living the dream. You're scuba diving among coral. How representative is that of your day-to-day?
I'm really pleased you asked that, because, there's what everyone thinks you do and then there's your day-to-day. So I'm very lucky that I spend time in the field. So I'd say if we took over the course of a year, I probably spend about a month of the year in the field. So by that meaning, I'll be actually out either in the mangroves or snorkeling or diving, collecting samples, doing ecological surveys and some form of research. Probably about another 3 to 4 months would be back at the university that I work at in the lab. So actually doing genetics, extracting DNA, actually sort of measuring physiological traits and other things of interest. And then the rest of my time is spent supervising students and writing up the research that I've conducted.
And where do you want to take your career and your research in the future?
So for me, this understanding the traits of resilience of corals and ensuring that we can continue to conserve and advocate for the protection of coral reefs, and particularly in regards to climate change, is really, you know, that's my career focus now and where I want to be. So hopefully in 10 years time, I'm continuing to do what I'm doing now, but hopefully having more impacts at all levels.
So how did you become a Rolex Associate Laureate?
Yeah, so I was looking online for opportunities to try and help fund some of the research expeditions that I wanted to go on to try and look for sort of these super corals, and came across the Rolex Awards for Enterprise and thought that it sounded like an amazing opportunity. And yeah, I put in an application.
So how has the prize changed the prospects of your project succeeding?
So receiving the funding and support from Rolex has given me the opportunity to run a research expedition later on this year up to some of the northern sites on the Great Barrier Reef. And this really sort of has provided a new opportunity to look for some of these more resilient corals and also study them. And particularly because sometimes research expeditions can be some of the harder projects to get funded through more traditional avenues. So that's where this award's been really beneficial.
And the Rolex Awards are part of the company's Perpetual Planet campaign to join forces with those finding solutions to environmental challenges. In this context, what would it take for your project to scale up and become widely applicable?
So part of our project is really trying to get a network of sort of hotspots of resilience where there are these corals that have got enhanced ability to withstand stress. We already know of several across different oceans. So we're hoping that through exposure, for example, of this project and also the increased capacity to undertake research expeditions, that we can expand on that network globally.
As Emma Camp explained, she was planning a trip to the Northern Great Barrier Reef for the end of this year when we spoke to her a couple of months ago. Well, she's had to change her plans slightly, and our producer, Holly Fisher, caught up with her a couple of weeks ago as she completed the first half of her expedition.
So we just had kind of a short expedition that went to an area called Low Isles and Woody Isles, and we were there looking at the corals that we know are in the mangroves there. And so we've actually got some corals in that particular mangrove lagoon that have been tagged for a year now, and I've been tracking their success and how they are developing and some of the sort of genetics and physiological traits of those corals. And the reason that the sort of more, I guess, exciting expedition to the farther north has actually had to be postponed till a little later in next year is because the coral spawning events that happen annually on the Great Barrier Reef, this year there was a split spawning event. So it actually means that over 2 months rather than 1 month, the corals spawn. And so part of the expedition, the sort of goal of the expedition, if you like, was actually to transplant some corals from the mangroves to the reef and the reef to the mangroves. But biologically, it's not very good to do that during spawning because their corals are just potentially under more stress. But what was exciting was that we've had sensors in there monitoring the corals that are there. And when we were there, for example, the seawater temperature, and we're not even at the hottest part of the year yet, was 37 degrees Celsius, which, you know, it's really very warm for corals to be surviving. And so actually seeing the corals that were there doing so well was really something that was very kind of exciting for us to witness. A lot of the mangrove lagoons where we work in, they're very shallow. So often, you know, we take the boat in and you're kind of meandering through channels that have cut through these dense mangrove lagoons. Then we get out and we walk through some of the areas and we're looking for corals and any other species that are sort of there. And so it's very, very different to a reef environment. And I think as well, the fact that you've got the mangrove canopy kind of, you know, kind of coming up beside you, you know, it's really kind of you're hunting like in this environment for these corals to be there. And also very mindful of the wildlife that there's also there. So on the trip that we just came back from at the moment, there's a nesting season for some of the birds and quite high crocodile activity. So we were quite vigilant during the expedition of potentially having crocodiles in the mangroves. Obviously it's a habitat where they're found, so that adds a little bit of apprehension and excitement during the trip. We've heard them a few times, which is interesting. They make a really interesting, it's kind of almost like a deep bullfrog sort of barking noise. The first time I heard that was quite an experience, and I left quite quickly to get back on the boat. We see a lot of sharks, and actually it's really exciting. The trip that we were just on, we had about 7 or 8 baby blacktip reef sharks. They're probably about 0.5 metre, all in the mangroves with us. They were feeding, and that was really amazing. They were like jumping out of the water and working together to try and kind of round up the bait ball of fish. So, you know, those experiences where you just happen to be in the, you know, in the environment at the right place in the right time is, yeah, really quite special. It reminds you how amazing these systems are, not just for corals, but for nursery habitats for other marine life. You know, I definitely, like, I love being in the mangroves. They're really, you know, these are like hotspots of resilience in terms of the corals that, you know, can survive there, but also a kind of learning point for us that we're going to lose diversity. We're going to potentially lose really important structure if we continue to go down the route that we're on. So again, it's kind of a real sort of mixture of emotions, I think, when you go into these systems, but they excite me because I think we can learn a lot from them.
That was Emma Camp, marine biologist and associate Rolex laureate, concluding the first half of this series of The Pioneers. We'll be back next year with more insights from some fascinating people with groundbreaking ideas. This programme was produced by Holly Fisher, and I'm Robert Bound. Thanks for listening.